Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus on Albany. I'm Cynthia Poore, and my guest today is Ross Barkin. And Ross is a writer for the Village Voice, and he is going to talk about the origins of Donald Trump's political endeavors, and I am going to get him on the phone now. So bear with me a second.
Hey.
Hey, we're on the air, Ross. So
okay.
We're here to talk about the origins of Donald Trump's political rise to power, and he got his start in the Bronx with the Democrats. Can you give us an overview of exactly what happened?
Sure. So Donald Trump, as many people know, is the son of Fred Trump, who was a very prominent real estate developer in Brooklyn, very politically powerful, had a very close relationship with the mayor, Abe Beame, in the 1970s, as well as many other elected officials. And, you know, Fred understood, as Donald did too, that in order to really build in New York City and to be successful, you needed to be politically connected. And so Donald found his way to the Bronx through Roy Cohn, who was a mentor of his, perhaps his first and most important mentor. And Roy Cohn was a very aggressive, nasty lawyer who made his name during the McCarthy hearings as being, you know, fiercely going after people suspected of being communist, and in many ways that was a witch hunt. And so Donald Trump hooks up with Roy Cohn in the 1970s, and Roy Cohn gives Trump many of the life lessons that he would take with him all the way to the White House, you know, including things like never apologize and, you know, always double down and always fight back no matter what. So Roy was from the Bronx, and Roy was very close with Stanley Friedman. They were actually law partners, and Stanley Friedman was the chairman of the Bronx Democratic Party and also a deputy mayor under Abe Beame. And so one of the first major, perhaps the first major real estate project that young Donald Trump did was the development of the old Commodore Hotel, which is right by Grand Central Station. And this was in the late 70s when New York was in a fiscal crisis and confidence in the city was quite low. And so in order to entice Donald to develop this building and make it into a nice new hotel, the city gave him an extremely generous tax abatement. At the time, it was maybe the biggest tax giveaway that the city had ever given to anyone for a real estate project. And the person who created this tax abatement really shoved it through through City Hall was Stanley Friedman, the Bronx Democratic Party big shot, who'd become party boss shortly after Beame left office and Ed Koch took over, and this was in the final days of the Beame administration. So Friedman, who's then deputy mayor, who's a heavyweight in the Bronx, really pushed through this tax abatement, and as a favor to you know, Roy Cohn, who he's very close with, and, you know, to Donald Trump, who's bringing bringing in Roy a lot of business.
So how generous was the tax abatement? Do you have any idea?
I have to go back and look at the figures. It was. I mean, I think it lasted about 40. It's like a 40-year, if I recall, a 40-year abatement. I don't have the numbers in front of me, but it is extremely, for its time, and certainly even today, there is on extremely generous terms. And part of it was that a Friedman knew Trump and wanted to do Trump and Roy Cohn a favor, since, again, Donald Trump was Roy Cohn's protege, and also that the city was very desperate for development at that time, when a lot of money was fleeing the city, and it was on the brink of bankruptcy. And so it is very hard to entice wealthy developers to build there. And so one way to do that was handing out major tax breaks. And that's how the 421A program began in the 1970s, as a way to lure developers to build here. And and that legacy is with us today, where we still, with 421A and other programs, still hand out a lot of very generous tax breaks for developers to build.
Now, this is, you said this was in the late 70s, so
Yes.
is this after the Daily News headline of Ford tells New York to drop dead?
Yes, I believe so. I think that headline was, so this was the end of the Beam years, and Beam left at the end of 1977. I think the Ford headline came a year or two earlier. I believe 76, 75, around then, yeah, 1975. And so, yeah, this was the tail end of 77. A. Beam had actually lost re-election to Ed Koch. And Stanley Friedman, who's a deputy mayor under Beam, and then shortly after he left the Beam administration, he became leader of the Bronx Democratic Party. And if anything, he grew closer to Ed Koch than he was to A. Beam, and he eventually was caught up in a major corruption scandal that would also do great damage to Ed Koch's reputation and to his city hall as well.
So Trump gets this tax abatement from the Democrats. After he gets the tax abatement, what was the relationship between Donald Trump and the Democratic Party in this New York City?
It was quite cozy. I mean, Donald Trump was not a Republican Party acolyte by any means. I mean, he'd been a registered Democrat. I'm not sure if at that time he was a registered Democrat. He may have been, but he was very close to the Democratic Party elites. He's following the example of his father, Fred, who is, worked extremely closely with politicians, mayors and governors, who he donated to. And Fred was very active in local politics, and Donald too was a frequent donor to Democratic candidates for office. And he was someone who was viewed as a fixture of the New York elite. And for politicians, he's a source of income, in terms of campaign donations. And then for Donald, he knew that no one in the private sector can really be successful, certainly not in the real estate sector, without the helping hand of government, without what some would call corporate welfare. And Fred certainly benefited tremendously from the government's help in terms of his ability to build middle income housing throughout Brooklyn and Queens. And Donald Trump too, with getting the tax abatement for the Commodore Hotel, he knew that being friends with the people in charge, which in New York City, invariably it's Democrats. Even if you have a Republican mayor, Democrats are still extremely powerful. He had to do business with them, and he was happy to. And he was not someone who was seen as ultra conservative or what he would become.
Now, Donald Trump, back when he was a Democrat, that was in the late 80s, correct?
I believe so. I know he changed his party registration quite a bit throughout his life. I know he's independent. He was a Democrat. He's Republican. I don't know. I'd have to look at the records. I don't know when exactly, if in the late 80s he was a Democrat. He very well could have been. He certainly was someone who was donating to Democrats, socializing with Democrats. Someone in many ways, embraced by powerful Democrats. I mean, he had a relationship with Mario Cuomo. He's talked about that. And he's been a donor to Andrew Cuomo's campaign. He's been a donor to Eric Schneiderman's campaign. So, I don't know exactly when he switched his registration. I would have to check that. Mm-hmm. But regardless, he was always very accommodating to Democrats and very willing to give them money. Until really shortly before he ran for president.
So back in the days when he first talked about his desire to be president of the United States, did he have thoughts of running for president? Although we can't get into Trump's head, would you believe he had thoughts of running for president as a Democrat?
I don't know if he ever thought about running as a Democrat. He certainly was toying with the idea since the 1980s, and there are interviews where he, speculates about it, thinks about what he would change. He's always very obsessed with trade imbalances, and in 2000 he was looking to run on a third party line, the Reform Party line, and I don't know if he ever thought specifically, like, I'll run as Democrat or, like, I'll run as Republican. I think it was always, like, Donald Trump thinks about running for president, and it'll always treat it as this strange little sideshow. In 2012, he did think about doing it as Republican. By that point, he was staunchly in the Republican wing, I would say. And that campaign,
right,
had he launched in 2012, would have been in the Republican primary. But going back to 2000 before, it was never entirely clear that he would absolutely run as a Republican.
So back in those days, describe how he was mentored by the party bosses in the Bronx, the Democratic Party bosses that gave him the knowledge to spread his wings and be a participant in politics.
Sure. I would say he's mentored by Roy Cohn, who was from the Bronx and was Stanley Friedman's law partner and was very much enmeshed with Bronx politics. So I don't know what lessons Friedman necessarily imparted on Donald Trump.
Okay.
Friedman, he's still around. If someone wants to find him, I think he lives in Florida. You can ask him. I do know that Roy Cohn, he gave Trump many of the lessons he still lives by. And one of those is that if someone hits you, you hit them back twice as hard. You never apologize. You never give in. You never settle. Roy Cohn was a big proponent of, always fighting, either fighting a lawsuit, bringing your own suit, attacking your opponent, attacking until they wear down. And, these were tactics that Donald Trump took to heart, and you could see it today in his presidency and the way he conducts himself. Donald Trump, to my knowledge, has never uttered the words, "I'm sorry." Maybe at some point he has. I have no recollection of him saying, "I'm sorry, I did this, I was wrong." And that goes directly back to Roy Cohn. And that goes back to, you know, the Bronx political machine, where, you know, you didn't issue too many mea culpas. You know, you did your business, you fought your fights, and you were unapologetically who you were. You're unapologetically power hungry, and Roy Cohn was like that, and Stanley Friedman was like that as well. And Donald Trump at no point hid his ambition or apologized for who he was, and never really apologized to anyone, and was never introspective in any way.
Now, Roy Cohn became famous as an ally of Joseph McCarthy, and McCarthy was a Republican. So, you know, there's so many interwoven things that it's really hard to keep up with. So when after McCarthy died and Cohen, you know, had his own law practice, he was always a Democrat. Would you say that was a fair assumption?
That that Roy Cohn was always a Democrat?
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, he certainly worked with Friedman, with the Democratic boss. I mean, I don't know what Roy Cohn's party registration was, or you know, how, if you know, I wouldn't say he was a necessarily staunch Democrat. It's obviously going back to his anti-communist days, and he was always quite conservative. So I think he always also had an affinity for Republicans as well. But, you know, he's someone who, again, understood where in New York City, you know, the wheels got greased, so to speak, or where power was created. And then the power lay in New York City with the Democratic Party, with the Democratic Party machines in the Bronx and Brooklyn and Queens, these county organizations into the 1980s still had a lot of power that they don't have today. And so for someone like Roy Cohn, regardless of how conservative he was, and he was very conservative, he had to do business. And when you're doing business in New York City, when you're trying to make money and trying to influence people, you can't be just simply a staunch conservative or a proud Republican and just throw up your hands and walk away and say, I'm not touching these corrupt liberals. You have to deal with them. And Roy Cohn understood that very well. And Donald Trump, you know, really thanks to the lessons of his father, who again was very, very close to the you know, Democratic power brokers in the city and state, whether you're talking mayors or governors. And Trump got that, and it was a lesson he never forgot.
Now, Fred Trump built all his empire outside of Manhattan. And it was Donald Trump who decided to come into Manhattan. Once Donald Trump made that decision to go into Manhattan, did he face any obstacles, or was things easy going for him?
Well, I mean, Fred helped pave the road. I mean, you go back to, you know, the Commodore Hotel deal, and you go back to, you know, how Roy Cohn, you know, and Stanley Friedman helped Donald Trump. You know, for most real estate developers who are only about 30 years old, like Donald Trump was at the time, you know, breaking into New York City and starting to Manhattan, certainly would have been quite difficult, but the fact is, and Wayne, the late, great Wayne Barrett, did a lot of reporting on this, and I suggest people read his book about Donald Trump to really get a sense of how Donald Trump rose to power. His father absolutely eased his path into Manhattan. And Donald Trump, you know, Donald Trump himself didn't have the net worth to, you know, guarantee loans or get bank documents signed or assure people that he was, you know, carrying a lot of money on him. It was the fact that he was Fred Trump's son that really allowed him to do the deals he did, because Fred Trump was someone who is very well known to, you know, to the banks, to the developers, to the politicians. And Fred was a very serious person. And so even if Donald was looked at, you know, as a bit of an oddball, as this flashy, ostentatious kid who maybe didn't quite always know what he was doing, the fact is he was Fred Trump's son. And if you are Fred Trump's son, you were going to get favors. And that's really the story of Donald Trump's early years in New York. It's being Fred Trump's son and, you know, being able to build his own little empire in Manhattan and, you know, his celebrity machine on the back of Fred Trump's accomplishments. And Fred Trump, you know, was a self-made, you know, millionaire and was a self-made power broker. And Donald Trump was a self-made celebrity, but he certainly was not a self-made wealthy person. You know, Fred Trump was very successful and passed that on to Donald.
Well, he also passed on the genius that Donald has in manipulating the media, because Fred Trump was also good at it. So he passed that on to his son. So overall, what's your impression of Donald Trump's rise to power?
Well, I think it's startling that he became president. It was an unprecedented election. It was something very few people understood or anticipated, and it is a phenomenon unlike any other. In terms of his successes in New York, or, you know, his rise to power, I mean, really, a lot of it was smoke and mirrors. You look at the fact that his businesses went bankrupt. Many of his, you know, his casino in Atlantic City was quite unsuccessful. I know his airline went out of business. I mean, he had many business failures, and he was someone who, by the late 80s and early 90s, looked like he was headed for financial destruction. And the remarkable thing about Donald Trump is he's been very good at spinning his failures as successes. And so even though he had, you know, business struggles that would have ended the careers of many other men and women, Donald Trump, maybe to his credit, or maybe this says more about the media or about our country, he was able to resurrect himself. And you know, he was someone who came from money, who was given every advantage in life, took advantage of these advantages, and on his own did build himself up as a celebrity, as a creature of New York City, as a tabloid creature. And he cultivated this. He built this image, but, you know, a lot of it, you know, it rested on shaky foundations. And even to this day, we don't really know his net worth, how much he owes, what he has in his bank account, because he doesn't release his tax returns. So we can't truly say Donald Trump is a supremely successful and wealthy man, because we don't know. He may very well be in debt and have a net worth far lower than he claims. But what we can say is that he was more successful at cultivating a celebrity persona than just about anyone. And he rode this all the way to the White House, and that's a remarkable story.
And do you think that the fact that Donald Trump became president of the United States not quite for intellect or knowledge, but celebrity, do you think that particular aspect is going to be with us, maybe on the presidential level, maybe even down ticket candidates? Do you think the celebrity aspect of politics is going to be with us for a while?
I think so. It was with us before Donald Trump. Donald Trump certainly is the first president to come out of the reality TV show world. So that was a very stark transition. Celebrity, as we've seen with Arnold Schwarzenegger becoming governor, Jesse Ventura becoming governor, even Barack Obama's rise to power, and I would say on the whole, Obama was a much more substantive person president
right.
than Donald Trump. But let's remember, his resume was quite thin. He was a one-term senator who hadn't even finished his term and who 4 years before being elected president was still a state senator. And he really captured the presidency on the strength of his own celebrity, again, that was created in a far shorter amount of time than Trump's. And you know, Obama was someone who rose from obscurity, whereas Trump had been famous for at least, you know, 30 plus years. But the Obama presidency in its own way in that first campaign was one built on images and excitement, some of which was superficial because, you know, he was such a, you know, remarkable figure, obviously the first black president, but also someone who very much became a celebrity as that campaign wore on. And I think for future campaigns, I mean, we can't really predict the dynamics, but certainly Trump has encouraged other major celebrities to think about running for president, running for office. We see Cynthia Nixon here in New York. We see Mark Cuban and The Rock and you know, mulling presidential bids, or Mark Zuckerberg. We see Kid Rock looking at a Senate seat in Michigan. And these aren't things we can laugh about anymore. I think that's the biggest difference. I'm not saying all these celebrities are going to win. I'm not saying they're all alike. I think, in fact, if you look at their records, they're quite different. I don't want to compare Cynthia Nixon to Kid Rock. But I, the biggest difference now is that we in the media and we as Americans have to take celebrity candidacy seriously. And the days of laughing them off are dead. And whether all these celebrities can win is another matter, whether people will crave a return to normalcy after Trump, which is very possible. We have to take real stock in celebrities running for office and look at them like we'd view, you know, a governor with a decorated resume or, you know, a highly touted senator.
Excuse me. I want to say one thing about the difference between Obama and Trump. Obama, true, he was a celebrity, but he was an insider. He got help from the party elders. Whereas Donald Trump did not have that luxury of being a party insider. He more or less crashed the party, and the people in this country just loved it. They don't care what he said, what he did, but he was challenging the status quo, and they liked that.
Yes, I mean, that's certainly, and Barack Obama came out of politics and had the endorsement of elected officials. I mean, Hillary was the favorite candidate of the party elders. But yes, I mean, Obama had Ted Kennedy's endorsement and had been in politics and was taken very seriously by Democratic Party officials, whereas Donald Trump completely stormed in from the outside and took the party over. I don't want to say they're too similar because they're really not. The point was more that we are in this era of celebrity that I think does predate Trump, and I think you can even go back to John F. Kennedy's election in 1960 as the dawn of this celebrity culture, where again you had someone who's very very handsome and charismatic in the new era of TV, and he was able to win an election, and that I think that kicked things off in a way. Now we're in a very different place than we were then, and we're going to continue to, you know, evolve into different phases, and we don't really know what's coming next, but we're definitely in a time of great uncertainty.
Now we're almost, it's almost time to, you know, close our interview for today. So Ross, tell us a little bit about what you're doing now. Are you still with the Village Voice?
So I write for the Voice still. I also write for the Guardian. I do a national politics column for them just about every week. And I write for some other places too. I've been writing a bit for a good website, Gothamist. And, you know, occasionally, you know, some other places, Columbia Journalism Review of late. But yeah, a lot of my regular local political work is still in the Voice.
Okay, great. So I hope, you know, it won't be too much longer before the legislator in Albany comes back. So I hope you'll come back on Focus on Albany to share your thoughts on this upcoming legislative session. So you have been listening to Ross Barkin, what's your title at the Village Voice?
I'm a contributor to the Voice, and I'm a columnist at the Guardian, if you want to, you could use those too.
Okay. So if you like this show, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, download on your smartphone, subscribe to iTunes, comment about this show, hashtag Focus on Albany on Twitter. Thanks, Ross. I look forward to talking with you again. And thank you, everybody, for listening. Have a wonderful day.
Thank you.